Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 4 of the JA3K podcast. Joining us today, we have special guest Rhiannon Bates.
Hey, everyone.
She's here to discuss with us about the docuseries Wild Wild Country. I hope you did your homework and watched it, Rhiannon.
Yeah, we actually watched it together.
Oh, right. I remember.
Yeah, this one will include a lot of spoilers about the docuseries Wild Wild Country, but it's a really great show, and I would recommend you watch it first. But if not, then we'll give you a little bit about it and talk about it.
Yeah, also, the events of the docuseries happened in 1985, so you can't spoil 1985.
Yeah, well, to start out, I really enjoyed this docuseries, and when we first started it back in July, I thought it was sort of boring, and I don't know if I would have kept watching it, but I'm really glad we did. And there's not that many episodes, like 10 or something.
Just six.
Six, and they're like an hour long each or something. But it just kept getting more and more interesting, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't watch enough TV. It took us like half a year to watch this six-episode docuseries.
Yeah. And another docuseries that we watched this year was The Tiger King, and it was really popular for a bit because that's when everyone had to stay home. There was like that spike in COVID, but now, of course, the cases are much higher, and everyone's just like out and about and stuff. But
gotta give up eventually.
Everyone was at home, and The Tiger King was released, and everyone watched it, and it was just this, if you haven't seen it, it's this documentary about a man in Oklahoma or something owning a tiger, actually many tigers and lions.
Yeah, hence the king.
Yeah. and just, like, the crazy interpersonal relationships and, like, how, I don't know, weird and, like, you just, like, as you keep watching the episodes, you think that it can't get any stranger, but it does, and there's still unsolved things, and the way they depict all the characters, they show a lot of the good and bad things about them, and that's a good way to think about this Wild Wild Country docuseries.
Yeah, I feel like Wild Wild Country is, like, the opposite of Tiger King, because in Tiger King, there's all these, in both docuseries, there's all these characters which are, like, doing horrible things, I guess. But in Wild Wild Country, I feel like at the base of it, all the characters are very principled and empathetic, and, like, at the end, they actually, like, agree on the facts. Like, I felt like this docuseries was, like, building up to this, like, he said, she said moment where, like, fundamentally, like, the two sides just saw reality differently. But they kind of, like, mutually understood what happened. But they just had, like, very different interpretations of the moral significance of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, in Tiger King, like, his Caroline Baskins gets, like, accused of murdering her husband, and that's sort of unresolved. And, of course, she denies it. But in this docuseries, Sheila, like, poisons a whole town. And then she's like, yeah, I did that, and it was morally justified. See what this country did to Catholics, Mormons, Black people. They made a mistake coming after our religious minority, though.
Yeah, well, so to set the stage, Sheila is a main character that Jake is describing, and it's basically about this cult that, I don't know, maybe Jake has a better way to describe it, but Sheila plays a major role as, like, the secretary of this cult leader, and she everyone thinks that she's power hungry and, like, she wants to have all this control and does these bad things, but a lot of the docuseries, you know, it's focusing on all the different people around this cult leader. So his name is Bhagwan, but also Osho, that we find out later, like, he changes his name halfway through, so we'll just be calling him Osho for this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they, like, the whole docuseries, it's called Wild Wild Country because it's set in this small town in Oregon called Antelope or something, which is where the cult relocated to form this community from India. And You think that the docuseries is just going to be, you know, like about this one man, his cult and everything, but it's just mostly about everyone else involved, and we really don't get a good look at the actual, like, leader behind the cult, and maybe he's just kind of, like, not the real leader. Like, it seems like Sheila, that Jake was describing, this original secretary, had a huge part to play in building it up.
Yeah, the character of Osho is, like, strange, because the way everyone talks about him, it's like, oh, he's this amazing person who will change your life, but there are, like, clips of him talking in the documentary, and I don't know, it's like, nothing he says is that compelling. I don't, maybe you have to listen to him longer than just, like, a sentence or two to, or, like, be in his, like, actual presence and not just watch a recording.
Yeah, the whole time we were watching the series, we were just kind of waiting to, well, I was waiting to really understand, like, why everyone was so moved by this leader, and, like, Sila is this really intelligent and, like, strong woman who is totally in love or something with him. Mm-hmm. Like, spiritually, I guess? I don't know. But, yeah, Osho says that he never has sex with his secretaries.
Oh, yeah, like, in the... when Sheila runs away, because, like, I guess it wasn't okay with the Bhagwan that she was poisoning everyone and organizing assassinations and whatnot. He's like, yeah, maybe she had to leave because she was in love with me, and the love affair turned sour, turned into a hate affair, and he never sleeps with his secretaries.
Yeah, and this, like, whole thing was videotaped, and there was a live audience, and everyone just, like, started laughing or
yeah,
something.
I guess it was the 80s. Yeah. It was a funny joke because everyone else was sleeping with their secretaries.
Yeah, the whole audience.
Yeah.
I think that this podcast will be hard to, I don't know, easily go through this whole docuseries because I feel like we're getting a little jumbled or something.
There's a lot to say.
There's a lot to say, and there's a lot of, like, different parts to this docuseries that... it's hard to understand, like, until you, like, start watching it and everything. But there's, like, a lot of interesting themes that hopefully we'll talk about.
But before we get to a theme, on the jumping around theme, I wanted to mention one thing about Tiger King. In Tiger King, the main character, the king himself, ran for governor of Oklahoma. And the whole time, they're like, it's the stupidest thing. Obviously, he can't win. Everyone around him is like, I don't know why he wanted to do that. And you just have this impression of this doomed campaign. And the only thing you hear about the results of the campaign is they put up a infographic of, like, CNN, and you can and he got 11% of the vote, and anyone who got 11% of the vote could have won, you know? Like, if I ran for governor of Ohio, I wouldn't get 11% of the vote. That's, like, a major accomplishment to get 11% of the vote.
Yeah, it was a really interesting documentary series. So this Wild Wild Country, the followers of Bhagwan move to Oregon to start this community, and Sheila basically, like, helps build this community from scratch and everything. And then later throughout the episodes, we'll see that there's a lot of tension between the town and then the community that is formed. And there's, like, a lot of voting fraud or something, or, like, attempted fraud, or... I don't know. Wasn't there, like, something...
Oh, like, yeah. That? Like, they wanted to win, like, all the local government positions, like the mayor and whatnot, in Antelope, which I guess they should have been able to do because they had so many people in their cult. I don't know why they failed in the end. I guess it was a larger region than just, like... Because they interview some people in the town, and you get this impression of, like, a one-street town, and maybe it was actually, like, 1,000 or so people, or somehow that... they outnumbered him.
Yeah. But anyways, you know, it seems like a really fun community. Oh, yeah, and the I forget what the followers are called, but, like, that... The Rajneesh. Yeah, the Rajneesh, like, they're really into, like, the central theme or something of that was that if you get into a state of, like, intense emotion or something, or, like... people are, like, screaming and, like, dancing around, and then And then you, like, have to have this, like, extreme silence and, like, do nothing. And, like, with a group of people, you're, like, lying on the floor, trying to, like, block out your senses. And somehow, like, that'll bring you closer to enlightenment. Is that...
Yeah, I remember clips of them, like, screaming and clips of them just lying there. And they talked a lot about, like, them just having sex all the time. Though I guess there wasn't any footage of that.
Yeah. There were a lot of footage of naked people, though.
Yeah, yeah.
So now I know that you all are going to run to your computers.
Yeah, you should watch the docuseries.
But, yeah. And there were a lot of interviews with people who were involved in the community. And one person who was interviewed a lot was Sila's, like, right-hand woman or something. And she was involved in some, like, attempted murder of, like, some... government official.
Yeah, they were going to murder the attorney general.
Yeah, right? The attorney general, because they wanted to deport Osho back to India. They were trying to find, like, immigration violations or something like that, because he would have people get married, like have arranged marriages or something like that, and then, like, rejoin the community so they could be citizens.
Yeah, but, yeah, because I guess the Bhagwan's teachings were against marriage, but somehow he'd have his followers come in, meet in some, like, city in the United States, and then get married, and then just to get green cards.
Yeah. But anyways, so one person who was, like, trying to attack this, like, attorney general, and it didn't really sound like she knew exactly what she was doing or, like, had really thought about the consequences or anything, but she, sorry, this is really confusing. Like, she made this analogy with, like, her own life with the teachings of Osho about how, like, you get to this breaking point and then you reach enlightenment or something like that, and the fact that she was almost going to attempt murder of this attorney general, and then, or, like, all the things that happened, and then she also, like, tried to kill Osho's doctor or something.
Oh, yeah, that one got a little further along. She actually, like, stabbed him with a syringe that was supposed to be poison or something, or...
Yeah.
I don't know how they messed up the assassination attempt.
Yeah. But anyways, the doctor survived anyways, so... But she, yeah, she was trying to kill the doctor, and that failed, so she was sent to prison for 10 years that we find out later. But she used this analogy of, like, comparing her own life, and that she hoped that she had reached enlightenment from all the things that she had done, and I guess, like, the turning point for her for leaving the religion was that she couldn't see her kids when she was in jail or something. But the, like, a main teaching of the Rajneeshi, like, was reaching some point and then being calm or something, but then also, like, embracing this cult-like behavior or something and loving everyone and free sex.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I thought she was saying that something about having missed enlightenment, and she was worried that she had, like, failed to be enlightened.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was worried that she hadn't reached that even after, like, as she reached the point, like, if she had missed it or mm-hmm. something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, something that confused me about that part of the documentary is, so she gets sentenced to 10 years for the attempted assassination of Osho's doctor, but then after her sentence, she goes to Germany, and there's, like, still a warrant for her arrest for the attempted murder of the, or the plot to assassinate the attorney general. I guess they never got to this stage of actually attempting it, but they had, like, the conspiracy charges. But why didn't they prosecute those charges? I guess they, like, just held on to those charges so she couldn't return to the United States after she finished her sentence. I don't know. It was a little confusing to me. Or if, like, maybe more evidence came to light as people wrote books about their experiences or something.
Yeah, it was confusing. Yeah, I thought that it was really interesting to hear Sheila's interviews, because we see all these people and they're giving interviews and they all have very unique rooms and settings and stuff like that. So then as you learn more and more about what they did, like, you wonder what they're doing now and, like, how they came to that point, because like when you get to the episode of like the killings and like the obvious, the poisonings of salmonella to the townspeople to prevent them from voting, like you wonder like, oh, is she just in jail or something? Because all these people are in kind of nice locations and everything, like they're wearing nice clothes, and like all these past community members are very eloquent, or like they're speaking very intelligibly and stuff. And
yeah, I do not know how Sheila only got like 2.5 years
yeah.
for like conspiracy to poison a whole town. And
no,
like,
no, I think she got 4 years.
4 years? Oh,
yeah.
Right. Uh-huh.
But she doesn't live in America, right? She's in Germany or
something? Yeah, I think it was a condition of her sentence that she had to leave the United States after serving her term. I guess she wasn't a U.S. citizen.
Yeah. I don't know. One of the most interesting things for me was that was Sheila, and like how everyone's saying how she's so power hungry, and then like one of the lawyers who got her statement said that she answered all the questions very honestly, but he had never seen someone with such a lack of empathy. And then at the very end we see that she's been working at like some hospice care and like caring for dementia patients, and obviously like that requires so much empathy and everything, so like she obviously cares about the community and she loved what she did, but I don't know how someone could do the poisonings and everything as well. She must have like really believed in the community in order to do that to other people or something.
Yeah, she must have really seen like the natives of Antelope as like the aggressors in their relationship, and somehow like her poisonings and stuff were justified to protect the community.
And they were, like, we saw the scene of some of the people from Antelope like destroying property and stuff.
Wait, what was that scene?
I think they were like carrying around guns or something, and I think there was some violence on both sides though.
Uh-huh.
Because before the Rajneeshis like burned some building, like they set fire to a building, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so before that happened there was like an attack before.
Oh.
That set them off to do it.
Oh, okay. I guess I forgot that part.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I guess for all the characters, you can really see, like, I feel like they were very honest throughout the whole process. And probably the documentary left out some key bits of information, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, it seems like Sheila and Osho and the federal prosecutors are all very principled people, just like their principles are incompatible. So, I don't know, the documentary made me feel like we're missing some spirituality in our own lives. I don't know, did it make you feel like that at all? It's like,
oh, yeah,
what are they
yeah.
even talking about?
That...
Like, the lawyer talks easily. Like,
yeah.
I don't know how Osho has such a presence.
Yeah, well, that made me think about another thing that I was going to bring up, which was, like, we were discussing before this podcast that we don't know, like, how much... I guess, actually, in the podcast, they kind of allude to this, but we don't know, like, how much of the teachings of Osho or the, you know, like, just the general community was so valuable to the people. Like, they were so devoted to following this guy who barely even spoke. I mean, I guess he had a lot of teachings and wrote a lot of books beforehand, but I don't know if it was, like, just the fact that there was a community of a few hundred, like, 100 people or something like that, and people felt like they had a place of belonging, or if it was like the actual teachings of this religion or something that
mm-hmm.
drew people in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seemed like the community must have been the more important part. But yeah, the way Tolks talked about the presence of Osho, I don't know, maybe the community wasn't the only thing.
Yeah, Tolks is the official lawyer of Osho, and he has a central part in I don't know, he has a lot of really good insight and everything, and he was just always moved by tears, like, when he was talking about Osho and how he's writing a book about his life and stuff, because that was his dying wish.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because Osho felt like he was, like, unfairly prosecuted in the United States. And I don't know, I guess, like, the lawyer was saying that it was, like, a really weak case, and they would get him off.
Yeah, it does seem, like, really malicious or something for the U.S. government to... They transported him for 3 weeks before he could be back in Oregon or something in order to, like, wear him down and, like, make him surrender or something.
Yeah, yeah. And he's, like, really old.
And they had... I don't know. Like, he was still innocent, right? Like,
yeah, he hadn't yet been convicted. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so you were going to talk about the spirituality in our own lives. I feel like, I don't know, we're not very religious people.
For sure not, yeah.
We
should start our own religion, yeah. We can start our own podcast, we can start our own religion.
Yeah, we already have followers, or at least you have followers.
Oh yeah, yeah, I have like 40 followers.
I actually have followers too, but they're all your followers.
Oh yeah. All those people that follow us on Twitter are now members of a cult. They don't even know it. If you're listening to this, await further instruction.
I started reading the book Sapiens recently, and I learned that humans can only really cooperate with 100 people. And then beyond that, we have to make these lies or like mythologies or something about the world in order for strangers to cooperate. Mm-hmm. So,
well, you can only cooperate with groups up to 100 with like mutual knowledge of each other and interpersonal relationships,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. I guess. Yeah.
Or more than that, you need money or something.
Yeah. And I wonder if being in a community like that is just more fulfilling and more, like, I don't know if you could call it spiritual or something, than the fact that we're living in this society with a lot of different people and stuff. But we also have things that we never would have been able to have, like, if not for all the people who have collaborated and, yeah, I don't know, made my tea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tea is pretty great.
I don't know, do you think that we would be happier in a cult of small, like, a smaller group?
Yeah, we'd probably be happier. That's probably true. Where are we going to find a cult, though? Can we join a cult where everyone wears red? I thought that was, like, a really nice style for the Rajneeshis.
Yeah, that color looked really good on people, I thought. Just in general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you have something to say about spirituality?
I don't know. I feel like I'm just missing out. Like, I don't even know what people are talking about. Like, when people say that they're spiritual but not religious, like, what do they even mean? Like, what are they seeing in the world?
I guess I kind of thought about spirituality as, I don't know, like, enriching your soul or something. Like, knowing that there's not, like, a higher being necessarily, but there's, like, something outside of yourself. And I guess, like, when I talk about that, I'm meaning, like, the ego or something. Like, when you think about, like, the voice that's inside your head, like, you have the ability to control that. And a lot of people call that the ego, is, like, what you, like, respond to automatically. And the ego can be, like, offended and angry and everything. But, like, there's another part of you that can recognize that and choose not to listen to that. And doing things that kind of, like, feed your soul, I feel like, is part of spirituality.
I'm not sure I understand.
Like, when you have thoughts that come to your head, when someone, like, offends you or makes you angry and stuff like that, like, you can recognize that you're feeling that way.
Yeah, like, but isn't that emotionality, or are you not drawing a distinction between those two concepts?
Yeah, like, you're feeling an emotion, but you are not, like, you don't have to be led by those emotions.
Hmm.
like, the emotions don't have to rule your life.
Yeah. I don't know. This almost seems like the opposite of spirituality to me. It seems like some kind of, like, rationality thing.
Yeah, maybe. Isn't the point. Well, I don't know. I guess, like, to me, I've never believed in any religion my whole life. And I guess, like, when I think about spirituality, it's like a feeling of calm or something. And I feel like when you are not being affected by, like, outside sources that, like, are immediately controlling your emotions, I feel like that's a way of, like, recognizing that there's a part of yourself that it can be, like, can look down and, I don't know.
I mean, so from your start, it's all about, like, different parts of yourself looking at yourself?
No, I don't know. That's a bad way to describe it.
Oh, okay. Not like, just different parts. There's, like, one part that's more you. That's not, like, the reactive part.
Well, if you think about if you are, like, deciding for yourself how to think and act and everything, like, everyone's going to have some, like, emotional response to situations, but you can choose how you respond to that. Like, you're feeling, like, sad or something, or, like, or something bad happened to you, or that, I guess that's, like, the best example. And then you can choose how to respond to that, and you can also choose to believe that everyone is connected in some way. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, there's, like, everyone is, like, if you believe everyone has a soul and stuff, like, everyone,
I feel like I'm a very, like, even-tempered person in the face of, like, worse things than I expect happening. Maybe
I've seen you, like, very frustrated before.
Oh, yeah. Well, only when I'm trying to use computers.
Which is always.
Yeah. You know, it's so dumb, because literally everything that anyone's ever done with a computer should be easy, but somehow that's not the case. Yeah, I had a lot of trouble with the VM. Maybe you're right. Maybe I need some of the spirituality as you describe it.
I don't know. Another thing that I learned from Sapiens is, or maybe not learned, but I feel like he brought up a good point, which is that our society has been so ingrained for material things, and everyone is like, so our whole lives are built around this lie that we tell ourselves in order for everyone to cooperate. And one of those things is, like, the individual self and, like, self-centeredness. So everyone has their own room. Everyone has their own, like, little space to be themselves, you know, to be, like, isolated and individual. But it kind of gets away from the idea that everyone is, like, connected and everyone is, like, in a group, you know. Like, having separate rooms is, like, built on the fact that we're all, like, trying to make it in the world and stuff, and, like, doing our part to work hard and not together, but, like, separate or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you said that, I really thought about that too. Yeah, it is a strange architectural thing that changes the way we see ourselves and each other, just separateness. There's a lot of modern discourse about privacy, which privacy is sort of like a very modern concept, right? Like, yeah, I guess people didn't have their own rooms until like 100 years ago, right?
Yeah, yeah. He was talking about like back when there were castles and stuff like that. Like, I don't know, the people didn't have their own rooms. Like, people slept in huge halls or something. Like, people slept in a big room. And they just, like, slept together, and then your value or something, like, how you wanted to be valued was, like, how other people saw you. So, like, it's not that you did some accomplishment, it's that, like, what other people said about you was the most important thing. Like, you know, like, to keep the family name or something. It wasn't, like, about you, it was, like, about, I don't know. I guess that was one example, but...
Mm-hmm. Is that different today? I feel like most people's value derives from what other people say about them. But usually people say it with money today, I guess.
Yeah.
It's kind of a funny thing about money, which is so obvious, but so deep, that the only way to get money is to be given it. Like, everyone who has money was given the money by someone for some reason. Maybe their parents, maybe their customers. I don't know.
Well, what would be the alternative? Like, to generate money?
No, it's good that it is this way. But it's sort of funny, because I feel like in our language it sometimes seems like wealth is a static thing, when it's like not inherent to the individual, it's always given, so it's always an interpersonal thing. I guess some people have had it for so long that you forget that they could have been another way. They could have been who they are without the money.
Oh yeah, it's interesting to say like it's an interpersonal thing, like, like, anyone who gives you money is, like, treated by the law as a person, right?
Oh, yeah, like the corporation and stuff. Yeah. Well, I mean, it is ultimately people in the corporation that decide to give you money, right? There's, like, interviewers and recruiters and...
Yeah.
Not just one person, but
do you think that computers will ever be treated as, like legally as people?
I don't know. That's a hard question. I would say in the world where we get to that stage is a very good world, because it's a world where the computers didn't just like kill us all when it was clear that they were as smart as us. But I think in a utopian future, computer programs will have moral weight similar to humans, at least some of them. I think moral weight for humans is derived in large part from their like consciousness, that they're like aware of their suffering and their pleasure, or not aware of their suffering and pleasure, but that they have suffering and pleasure at all. And it's like, it's a little unclear if computer programs can have those things, and if they can't, maybe they have no ethical weight, so they shouldn't have legal rights either. But in another sense, maybe they can. I guess there's like this deep question of what consciousness is and if it's a property of computation or of physical systems, which isn't clear to me. I don't think it's known yet. But I guess whether morally speaking they have an equal standing to humans is kind of an orthogonal question to whether legally speaking they'll be treated similarly to humans. It seems like if we make computer programs that behave like humans, but like behave like very smart, goal-oriented humans, it's conceivable that they'll end up controlling most of, like, the resources in the world. Sorry, my computer is sleeping. I think it's still recording. Yeah, it's still recording. Sorry about that. But no, it seems like if we make some computer programs and some computers lobby for legal rights and some don't, the ones that secure legal rights will secure more resources and make more copies of themselves, and they'll just be eventually only computer programs that want to have legal standing, just evolutionarily. But I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine like some kind of multipolar computer program or AI scenario where there's lots of artificial intelligences with different goals, and like it seems like the first computer program that is smarter than humans and goal oriented and kind of like gets out into the world will be the last, and like all future ones will somehow be copies of it. Because like, I don't know, computer programs have all kinds of properties that humans don't, like they make exact copies of themselves. So if they're all just exact copies, I don't know, it seems like maybe if the computer program has like desires, it'll desire things for its copies as well as for itself.
Do you think it's like a bad thing if a program is like has small mutations or something, like small changes in the program that happen randomly? Or does that even happen?
Oh, you mean like by design or like by like cosmic rays altering the computers?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it seems like a lot of AI approaches are based around, like, small mutations to programs. So, like what is a neural net, right? A neural net is a composition of matrices and nonlinear components, and then you randomly alter the parameters of the matrices, except not randomly. You, like, apply a gradient descent, and I think there's like some kind of stochastic thing called annealing, so it's like not deterministic from the gradient, how you update the neural net. But I think most modern approaches to artificial intelligence could be vaguely summarized as randomly changing programs until they do good. But yeah, for some notion of random change and for some other notion of do good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think there are like evolutionary approaches. I remember doing something like this in high school where we like, I don't think we ever got something working. I forget if we were trying to like do some game or something, but we had a model of like gametes in our AI that like conferred some trait, and then we like, I guess we hand selected the space of traits that we wanted to select over, and we like somehow had some mating thing where like successful agents in the game we were playing would swap traits. But I don't know. I don't think I was doing that. I think my friend was doing that. I don't know I forget exactly what the game we were trying to do well in was. But I don't think I don't think approaches modeled after evolution are nearly as successful as approaches modeled after gradient descent.
Yeah, I don't know. I just like was thinking about all these different computer programs, and if there's one computer program that lobbies for the legal status or something, and then replicates its program somehow, like if there's some random mutation, I mean, probably there's like very low error rate, but it just reminds me of viruses and stuff, and like how they propagate. There's actually like every time someone has coronavirus, like there's so many different viruses that have different mutations and stuff like that, and then over time, like now we have this like Columbus strain that is a dominant, like some mutation or something that stuck around, and somehow it's more transmissible or something.
Mm-hmm. Columbus is where we live for the viewers, listeners. But yeah, I hear a lot more about like the London and South African strains. So
yeah,
those are pretty far away. Just yeah. A whole plane right away. So.
Yeah. Maybe we've gotten a little off topic from Wild Wild Country.
No, this is good. This is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of think like the scenarios where computer programs or AIs like interface with the legal system and the human power structures that be to secure influence is like not that likely. I don't know. I kind of feel like we, like as a human, to do anything, you kind of have to like get help from other people. Like if you want to feed yourself, you go to the grocery store and exchange your money for goods and services. But to get your money, you like contact some recruiters or whatever to like get a job. And then like to do anything, it's like all intermediated through other people. But it's like, it's unclear to me that like once there's an agent that can copy itself and is also smarter than people, that it would have any reason to cooperate with humans, like that it would need anything from us. But I guess it depends like how rapidly you think we like cross this transition between AIs clearly being less competent than humans and clearly being more competent. If you think it's like many years, maybe there's like some scenario where like AIs are dumb people for a decade.
Well, how do you know that like an AI, even if it wants like legal status or something, has like desires?
Like desires in the sense of like a subjective feeling of wanting something, or desires as in like its like behavior is oriented towards obtaining something?
Yeah, it has like goals or something. Like if it's gonna take over or something like that, it needs to have some like thing that it's I don't know, like if a program like just like copied and like the AI is learning, but how does it know that like once the humans are gone it'll have like more room to do what it wants, or
mm-hmm.
or I don't know.
Yeah I guess like there's this idea that of goal convergence, where like for a wide spectrum of things you might want, your first step is to get more like influence. Like, so I don't know, maybe if it just wants to, like, run its program on more computers, it'll, like, want, like, a lot of control of natural resources like silicon and chip manufacturing and the data centers, and eventually that'll displace, like, our need for those resources to survive. I guess, like, the goal convergence is pretty clear in humans, right? Like, no matter where you want to fly in the world, your first step is to, like, go to the airport. So, like, a lot of goals start with this first step of, like, obtaining more optionality. Like, a lot of people seem to spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to get more money, but really their goal is to, like, I don't know, have nicer stuff or
be happy.
Maybe it's just to be happy. But yeah, the money is worthless except in exchange. But no matter what physical thing you desire, you're best served by starting by getting a lot of money, because the money will help you get the physical thing that you want. But I don't know if that's that related to what you said.
I don't really know that much about AI.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't either. Should we get back to Wild Country, or should we just stop here? I don't know.
Yeah. I guess, like, with the Wild Country, the love of the community and maybe the teachings of Osho, which he has been selling a lot of books lately stuff.
Well, not him. He's dead.
Yeah.
Oh, that reminds me of something I wanted to say. So Sheila accused, like, the people around Osho, like his doctor and these, like, rich LA types of, like,
drugging him
and, like, being directly involved with his death and then profiting and looting his, like, commune afterwards. And his doctor, there's, like, a scene after he died where his doctor, like, announces his death, and his doctor's like, he was in death exactly as you would have expected. Beautiful?
Or no, it was, like,
stunning.
Excellent.
Yeah. It was, like, a very weird, I don't know, it felt like he was describing, like, some restaurant. He was like, the restaurant was exactly as you would have expected. Excellent. Yeah. It just didn't feel, like, spiritual or powerful. I don't know. It was like, and then I was like, oh my god, Sheila's totally right. This guy killed him. But I don't really know. But yeah, maybe we should read some of Osho's books and do a follow-up podcast where we discuss Osho's teachings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe he just didn't speak English that well, because he always spoke really slowly. And I don't know, maybe just whatever language he started out in, he was more compelling as a teacher.
He had these very penetrating eyes.
Yeah, he would, like, look at the... Yeah.
He would just stare at one person so intently and speak very slowly, and it was almost hard to understand him.
Mm.
So I don't know, like, you had to be concentrating really hard.
Mm-hmm.
yeah the town, they had this back and forth with, like, what people thought of the cult and then the people inside the cult who were very emotional and said it was the best time of their lives and they never felt so connected or happy. And then the outsiders would say that, you know, everyone involved with, like, starting this community and stuff like that were out to, you know, get these people who were looking for enlightenment. They wanted, like, people who went to India and stuff like that, they wanted to have this experience. They wanted a guru. And it was easy to swindle them or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was actually one of the most emotional parts of this series to me, when the commune was breaking up. And they actually had, like, interviews with people at that time. And, yeah, it just seemed like such a sense of loss that they, like, I don't know, they felt like they belonged. And now they didn't know where they belonged. But, yeah, the other thing you said, yeah, it does kind of feel like a lot of spirituality is adjacent to, like, something exploitative. I don't know. Like, it does now seem like Osho's cult, after Osho's passing, has evolved into something commercial. Yeah. Commercial. But I don't know. They didn't focus that much about after Osho's passing. That's sort of the wrapping up of the documentary. I don't know. I guess a lot of whatever spirituality is, it seems like an important part of it is being like very open and trusting. And I guess very open and trusting people are easy to swindle. So I guess it's not too surprising that if there's some like true or important spirituality, it's always adjacent to shills.
Yeah. And maybe, I don't know, it was a combination of all of that. Like, they really did have a great time, but they were also, like, especially open to new ideas and stuff, and it stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap up. Thank you so much for coming to the studio, Rihanna.
Yeah. I loved being here.
Yeah, and thanks, thanks to all my listeners for the support. I hope everyone's doing as well as they can. Goodbye.
Stop.